You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Kevin Alexander, an advanced heart failure trained cardiologist and assistant professor of cardiovascular medicine at Stanford University School of Medicine. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for use healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kevin Alexander, a heart failure and transplant cardiologist at Stanford University and a member of the Stanford Amyloid Center. Welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on ATTR-CM. Today, we'll discuss the role of artificial intelligence for screening and diagnosing ATTR-CM patients. And I'm honored to have our guest today, Dr. Lily Stern. Dr. Stern is a cardiologist and assistant professor at Cedars-Sinai Schmidt Heart Institute, and she's the co-director of the Cardiac Amyloidosis Center there. In addition to expertise in cardiac amyloidosis, she also sees patients with advanced heart disease and patients undergoing transplantation and mechanical circulatory support. Her research interests include investigation of epidemiologic patterns, diagnostic tests, and novel therapeutics for patients with cardiac amyloidosis. So welcome to In Discussion and welcome, Lily.
Thank you so much for having me.
So yeah, icebreaker that we've been doing is asking everyone, if you weren't an amyloidologist and transplant cardiologist, what would you be doing in life?
I love that question because before I was a doctor, I actually was a singer-songwriter. So when I was in college, I did a ton of performing and I think people thought I was going to go into music. And then I thought about the pathways of music versus medicine. And I felt like medicine was an easier path. And now I just sing and play guitar and my family and for my little 20-month-old.
Ah, awesome. And so you're perfect for a podcast then. You could probably give me some pointers for how to conduct these. So awesome. Okay. Oh,
we'll see. I keep losing my voice being on service, talking through the mass, but excited to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. So I think artificial intelligence has revolutionized a lot of aspects of medicine, and it's moving very quickly. I kind of wanted to get your take of the overall landscape and then dive down specifically into some topics in ATTR-CM. What are your general thoughts about how artificial intelligence can improve care in cardiovascular disease in general, and what are some of the modalities that people are studying?
We're in an era of afferent overload. So there's just so much data coming at us from every angle. So we have in-person visits, messages through our medical records, emails, calls, nurses coming to us with questions, even texts from patients and colleagues. And it's just a completely different world than 30 years ago where we had paper charts and pagers. So we've all had to adapt and find shortcuts to multitask, relying heavily on type one thinking, which is that quick, reflexive decision-making. But the reality is that no one's actually good at multitasking and task switching. And even the best doctors truly just can't thrive in that environment. And we're really in that environment right now. So as clinicians, our real job is to find the signal from the noise so we can just focus on higher level diagnostic and management decisions, and to engage in that slower, more thoughtful type two thinking for our patients. But it's just so hard when we're inundated with so much information. So I think that that's where AI really has the capacity to help us in multiple ways. So first, you know, it can help offload the administrative burden that we have with assistance with documentation and communication with patients and other providers. Also, it can help standardize diagnostics. So, for example, in ECHO, there are studies that show that AI has better reproducibility for measurement of left ventricular ejection fraction and cardiac dimensions, which is incredibly helpful when there's so much inter observer variation. And we often use these measurements to make critical clinical decisions, such as when to refer a patient for a procedure or surgery. And then specifically talking about kind of, you know, we'll talk about with cardiac amyloid today, AI can really help with the diagnosis of rare disease. I know we spend about 75% of our time in the early years of medical school learning about these zebra diagnoses, but in clinical practice, we're mostly seeing horses all day. And the more horses we see, you know, while simultaneously being distracted by all the demands that we have from every direction, the more prone we are to missing the zebras. So AI can help us ensure we aren't missing these rare diagnoses that could dramatically impact our patients' trajectories and quality of life. ultimately, I think the hope for artificial intelligence is that it can eventually help us identify which patients benefit from which treatments, which is really pertinent right now, particularly in the world of amyloid, where we have all these novel therapies. And that's ultimately the goal of precision medicine, which is what the hope is for the future in medicine.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great overview. Some of the things I took away from that, really, these are tools that can augment our ability as clinicians to care for patients and deliver more efficient care. And, you know, I like what you said about the type one thinking and how we're stretched in a lot of different directions. And that makes us vulnerable to missing those zebras when we have so many things that we're looking for. And I think a lot of times, you know, in amyloid, we give these complex algorithms and say, well, if this patient has this, this, and this, of course you should work them up for amyloid. Easy for us when we see so many of those patients, but, you know, ask a primary care physician or a general cardiologist who has a much broader scope of practice than at least I do, I think that's challenging because, you know, amyloid's one of many things that they need to keep an eye out for and are responsible for identifying patients. And I think that that's where, like you said, it can kind of augment the clinician's ability to find those patients earlier. And like we'll talk about in other podcasts, you know, that early diagnosis and detection is so important given the therapies that have come out and the data showing that they work much better with earlier stages of disease. You've been a leader in this space and have published nice work on artificial intelligence and cardiac amyloidosis. Could you tell us a little bit about the work that you've done and what kind of keeps you busy these days?
I actually fell into the world of AI by becoming passionate about cardiac amyloid and detection of the disease. As you said, you know, we know that treatments are most effective when initiated early in the disease course, but many patients end up presenting very late because the diagnosis is just missed because most people are just in their lane only thinking about their expertise. They're not necessarily, the cardiologist is not necessarily thinking about their carpal tunnel syndrome. I actually ended up working with David Ouyang, who you know well, who's become a pioneer in this field of AI and specifically machine learning in cardiology. And while he was at Stanford, before coming to Cedars, he and Paul Chang developed ECHONET screening, which is now called Envision Precision Cardiac Amyloid. And it's a deep learning model trained on parasternal long axis and apical four-chamber views from echocardiograms of patients with and without amyloid. And the model was first trained and validated on different mixed cohorts at Stanford, and then ultimately tested on held-out test cohorts from Cedars and the Unity Imaging Collaborative in the United Kingdom, giving us this international testing set as well. They also tested the model on a cohort of individuals with ATTR variant amyloid in the NeuroTransform trial of the TTR gene silencer eplontersen, and it showed that it was very accurate at predicting those with and without cardiac involvement. And so while the model has been validated retrospectively leading to its FDA approval, I've been working with David and colleagues on validating the AI tool prospectively. We ran the algorithm on echoes performed at Cedars between 2021 and 2023. To just describe the study that we're doing, we ran the what was called ECHONET screening at the time, but is now called Envision Precision Cardiac Amyloid, this model on all echoes that were performed at Cedars between 2021 and 2023. And then we reviewed the 500 patients with the highest risk prediction for cardiac amyloid. And we found that about 35% of them had known amyloid already. And what was really interesting is that about half of these patients were actually not in our reference cardiac amyloid database, but were identified through chart review. And this is really important because when we're thinking about how we design these AI models, we have to consider who is the reference cohort and what is the gold standard for diagnosis. So for many AI models being developed, a reference cardiac amyloid population from an advanced heart disease registry is what is used to train the models. So in the case of this model, if these patients' echoes, the ones who weren't in our registry, they had been in the test cohorts for the algorithm in the retrospective assessment, they would have been considered false positives, which would underestimate the accuracy of the model. And additionally, this is also a real concern in thinking about how we design these models because they may be skewed to miss early disease if they're trained to think that undiagnosed or unknown amyloid cases are actually negative for disease. And those are exactly the patients we most want to identify because they have the best outcomes with treatment. coming back to what we found, so in addition to 35% of the cohort with known amyloid, we had about 25% with an alternative etiology, such as, you know, we're such a big transplant center, so we had a lot of patients with myocardial edema post-heart transplant, or maybe longstanding diagnoses of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but we were, felt confident they didn't have amyloid because they hadn't progressed over many, many years. And then about 15% were deceased. But we went back through those patients as well, and many of them actually had significant red flags for amyloid in their chart review, but we can't actually say definitively they had it or didn't have it. And then another 10% were too frail or out of the age range or opted out of research, so they were excluded. And that left about 10% of that original 500 who are alive and eligible to be enrolled in the prospective portion of the study, which involves screening for cardiac amyloid with a consultation with a cardiologist or an amyloid expert. And then if appropriate, we would perform non-invasive AL and ATTR cardiomyopathy evaluation. So we're still in the midst of this portion, but we've now expanded the trial beyond just our center to other sites across the country. Thinking about the landscape of AI and echo, Envision Precision is one of the three echo-based models that are currently FDA approved, along with Echo Go that was produced by Ultromics and the Mayo Group, and then us too. But our prospective trial is one of the few that's actually in the process of prospectively validating the tool in real time.
Yeah, great. A couple of follow-up questions to that. First is, you know, I think you bring up the point of really it's important what the reference cohort is. And a lot of times when these are developed, they're developed at academic centers of excellence with well phenotyped and, you know, often kind of advanced disease patients. In amyloid, we're slowly moving the needle and identifying those earlier stage patients. Some of those folks are the asymptomatic variant carriers that we're following serially. And so we can kind of see the moment that their PYP starts to show some focal myocardial uptake, or the carpal tunnel positive biopsy folks, you know, Matt Hannah's group has shown us a lot of data on them. Their hearts are going to look different. What are your thoughts about how we can train the models better to understand the potential spectrum of the disease, so that asymptomatic carrier that transitions to having amyloid on one side of the spectrum to the advanced heart failure or severe amyloid cardiomyopathy on the other? I guess going forward, is that where you think prospective studies can help with that, or how can we incorporate that into the models?
I do. I also think it would be helpful to incorporate these models into some of the ongoing research that's being done just to understand more about the prevalence of this disease, because we still don't really know what is the true prevalence of this disease. We say, oh, you know, 10 to 15% of those who are above the age of 65 with aortic stenosis who are undergoing TAVR or aortic valve surgery may have amyloid. But then when you actually go out and you screen every single patient who's getting a TAVR in your center, it's really more like maybe 5% or maybe less. I think we just don't know. So if you look at like a population, for instance, the SCAN-MP study that's run by Matt Maurer and Rick Ruberg at Columbia and BU respectively, they have cohorts where they're actually screening every single person in the study. If we were able to, for instance, run that model on a cohort like that, where you really know who has disease, who doesn't have disease, so you know who are the true positives, who are the true negatives, versus studying it in just the general population where we won't necessarily have that validity of people's diagnoses.
My second question is, for the prospective study, that 10% where you're reaching out and screening them, what's been the uptake for participation? You know, I think one of the challenges, and this is, you know, also seen in the genetic testing world, is when you identify an abnormal result in a large population, and they're not necessarily your patient. And so you're reaching out to them and saying, hey, you might have this condition, it's deadly, it's dangerous, can we screen you for the study? I guess maybe tell us a little bit about how you've approached those patients. And then if you're able to share what your current experiences with participation.
Yeah, that's honestly the biggest challenge, because, you know, I've been working on this for, I think, the past 5 years, even when I was at the end of my fellowship. That's the biggest thing, is about patient recruitment. So we would first reach out to the patient's cardiologist if they had one, or even their primary care doctor, to say, hey, is it okay if we contact this patient? And most people said, yes, no problem. Some cardiologists felt like, hey, you know what, if there's a suspicion, I'd rather work them up myself. And that was fine. We said, okay, as long as it's being done, you know, in the right way, and we would oversee that and follow that up. But then when we went to actually contact the patients, it's very interesting. So me as a doctor, when I would reach out to patients directly, I had a very high acceptance rates of wanting to be involved in the study. But then when ultimately, you know, we started onboarding, having research coordinators help us, and even nurse practitioners to help us, we were getting a really poor yield. It was very interesting. So then when we returned to having more of the doctors call the patients, we did get a higher yield, which I think it has to do with a lot of patients being weary about doing research. I think the threshold for them to participate, interestingly, depending on who it was coming from, really affected it. A big issue is obviously this was, I think by the time we were doing this, it was a couple years later. So it was kind of a little bit of an older cohort. So there was a lot of loss to follow up, couldn't get people on the phone. And then if we did get people on the phone and we did get them seen in clinic and we would do virtual visits, so that way it wasn't a big burden on them to come into the clinic, just to go through their history and say, hey, could they actually really have amyloid or not? Should we send this testing? It was hard to get them to actually follow up and get the testing done, interestingly enough. So yes, and you see that in the published reports so far, even from other studies of smaller cohorts, where that's the biggest bottleneck, trying to get people into clinic, get them their testing to actually confirm whether they have the disease or not.
Yeah, I think it's almost warrants a study in and of itself of how to take results from, you know, broad-based screening and get patients to follow up on those recommendations, whether it's amyloid or other conditions. You know, we probably need more structured research around that. And we oftentimes focus on, say, identification, but the implementation piece of this, I think, is going to be extremely important and needs to be studied. And so those insights that you pointed out, I think, are things that can inform kind of future implementation of a screening tool like this. So that, you know, very interesting.
We learned a lot. So it was almost like we did this initial, we've been working our way through the kinks. And now I actually do feel like we have more of a well-oiled machine of how to make it work. I'm really hopeful. I think things have been running much more smoothly and with like a more modern cohort. And now that we have all the different sites and they can learn from our mistakes from the past, I think it is better as we move forward.
I also wonder, you know, as we implement more AI based screening tools just in general healthcare, if we counsel patients or even kind of let them know up front, when you get this test or get this study, we may reach out to you about results that come up from future analyses, right? So then it's almost like it becomes an expectation that these data that were collected in the past still could give us information in the future. I mean, I think it's a little bit different way of thinking about it. You know, we kind of think as test is static and cross-sectional, here's the result, that's it. But I think more and more of the data is going to be analyzing these are retrospective, identifying new results, almost kind of like with genetic testing, when you have a variant of unknown significance and later it gets upgraded. And so now it can change, you know, future management. I think that'll be interesting to see how that develops as well. Another question I have is, so you mentioned the model that you've been working on is echo-based. And, you know, there's groups that have looked at ECG-based AI screening for amyloid, echo, or both, or some combination that, you know, uses some EHR components as well. Can you maybe talk about what you think the pros and cons of some of these things individually are or in combination? I mean, how do you think about it? As these tools are being developed and we're thinking about implementing them, let's say your Center X that doesn't have any of these things, you're going to have to pick and you're going to have to kind of think about what makes sense in your practice setting. So, you know, how would you kind of think about that?
I think it's kind of overwhelming how much is going on in this space. It's hard to keep track, to keep up with all the new innovations in this field. And like you said, I think there have been many ECG models developed. And the strength of that is that, you know, an ECG is ubiquitous. Most cardiology offices can easily get an ECG. But I think the issue is that, you know, none of these models have actually been FDA approved yet. The reason is because their positive predictive value in the general population is just really low. For example, for every 20 ECGs that are flagged as having amyloid, only one of them may be a true positive for disease in that patient. So when used in clinical practice, this could potentially create a huge burden on the healthcare system and on patients. I think it just hasn't been ready for prime time yet. Whereas, as I mentioned, there are those three echo-based platforms that have been FDA approved. And it's interesting to think about each of their strengths and weaknesses. You know, so I think Echo Go and the S2 model have a really great sensitivity, but it's at the expense of specificity. So again, the positive predictive value is much lower and maybe higher in those populations where you're at a center of excellence where there's a high referral rate. But if you're out in the community, it may not be as helpful and may just cause a lot of false positives. I think the issue is if you refer, 19 people to go get a workup and they're all negative, you may lose faith in the tool. I think what they're trying to really emphasize with the Envision Precision model is to have actually a higher specificity at the cost of a lower sensitivity. They may not catch every single case with the idea to improve positive predictive value so that when patients are flagged as high risk for amyloid, they're more likely to actually have the disease. There are models that combine both, which, I don't think have actually been fully validated yet, but I'm hopeful that that will actually give us more information and provide more powerful risk assessment for this condition, or a diagnostic yield rather. And, it's also interesting to think about like who these models are approved for and who we should be running them in. I think Echo Go has been approved for patients who are above the age of 65, but they have to have heart failure, whereas S2, I think, has been approved for patients over 65, but they have to have an increased wall thickness on their baseline echo, whereas the Envision Precision, the LV wall thickness is kind of baked in because they use both the four-chamber view and the parasternal long view, with the parasternal long view being used to measure the LV dimensions and the apical four-chamber view for looking at, those texture features that all of them use. And then, going back to the EHR, because there are a lot of models that are also looking into, can we use just the medical record and look at ICD codes and all of that? And, there's tons of information that's in the medical record, which is amazing for machine learning, but, it can be a good and a bad thing. Because as we talked about, many cardiologists are working in busy practices, may not feel that they have the time to ask about non-cardiac symptoms. And we know that amyloid is a multi-system condition. So AI can kind of help to integrate that data and identify those multi-system red flags. And so that's kind of like the ideal. But the issue is with the EHR is that there's a lot of inaccurate information in the chart, particularly ICD codes. So even for amyloid itself, it's hard to tell who has ATTR variant from wild type with and without cardiac involvement. Sometimes you're just trying to close the encounter and you just click on whichever one comes up first. And so it's not the most accurate information. Or maybe someone gets this diagnosis and then later on saying, oh, suspicious for amyloid, but then they get ruled out for it. But in their record, it says, oh, they have amyloid. Garbage in is garbage out. And so I think we have to be really cautious with how we craft these models using the ICD codes.
Another question I have, these powerful tools I think will help us to identify more patients at Stanford and Cedars-Sinai and Columbia and so forth. One of the big issues in amyloid, as you know, is that even though we have these effective therapies and great diagnostics, some patients are just not even diagnosed. And oftentimes in the community, particularly as you get farther and farther away from an amyloid center, do you see a role for these AI tools for enabling people in rural areas and away from amyloid centers to start identifying patients? And if so, how would that look to you?
I mean, that's the ideal area, is that for people who are working in not as resource-rich settings, potentially, I think it's challenging because you don't want too many people with false positive diagnoses, because then all of them are going to be referred to these centers of excellence, make them drive 4 hours to get to that place to get the full evaluation. So it's really important that we improve test characteristics of these tests, and that when we do implement them, that we feel confident in their use. We need to decide what threshold is acceptable for false positive results, right? And there is that balance of, you want to catch as many true cases as possible, but you also don't want to overwhelm the system or cause unnecessary anxiety for patients for testing. I think also just practically thinking about how do we implement these models in the community, or even just anywhere in the world. We think about the ideal scenario is that these models run continuously in the background, so that anyone who gets an ECG or an echo is automatically screened or potentially flagged as having amyloid, which then triggers that consultation for further testing. But the issue is, there's also an issue with just money and how are these models actually reimbursed? So for ECHO, you know, there is this like provisional CPT code, but someone has to specifically order the test for reimbursement. So just like when we order strain, you have to like click a button that says, I would like to order strain on this patient. Or if you get a coronary CT result, you have to order specifically the fractional flow reserve CT AI algorithm. So if someone's ordering the special test, then they're already thinking about amyloid. So it may not actually be that helpful in that scenario. And it doesn't replace the non-invasive workup for the condition. I think it's all important that we're still educating clinicians to use their brains, not just depend on AI to make the diagnoses. But I think that it can be just another tool in their decision-making of who should we actually screen or not. And to help people, you know, who are just seeing like the horses every day, that they can then remember, oh, maybe this could be a zebra diagnosis.
Yeah, well said. So I think we covered a lot in a short time. And, you know, we could spend hours delving into this, just given the explosion of AI technology and in cardiac amyloidosis. So just some of my thoughts in wrapping up, I think you nicely outlined how AI can be assistant or augment us in clinical care, particularly as we have competing demands and many things that we have to think through in patients, and really help us to find that needle in the haystack and identify patients that we're probably missing, even though they're engaging in the healthcare system. The second thing would be that, you know, there's a number of AI models that have been created that utilize EHR, ECG, ECHO. They have different strengths and weaknesses. Perhaps kind of more complete data we can yield from an ECHO, just given kind of the information we get from morphology and function. It'll be important to see kind of how to utilize these models, either in isolation or combination. I think in the last part, you highlighted very nicely that one important thing with these models is being very thoughtful about what the false positivity rate or specificity is as we try to implement these in a real world setting. And I think particularly for those areas outside of amyloid centers of excellence, really emphasizing that high specificity, low positive, false positive rates can be extremely important. I mean, right now, I think this is a condition where for every patient we find, there's probably three or four that don't know they have amyloid. So we have a lot of work to do just to identify those obvious amyloid cases that aren't being diagnosed. I think once we get there to having a relatively high diagnostic rate, then sure, trying to find those early stage disease patients, et cetera, will be important. But I think not putting the cart before the horse, we really need to catch up and picking up these patients that have class three heart failure walking around with amyloid and we're missing them. So thanks again, Dr. Stern. And it was great talking about the role of AI for screening and diagnosing ATTR-CM. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Kevin Alexander for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Transthyretin Amyloid Cardiomyopathy podcast series with our host, Dr. Kevin Alexander. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy.